Chapter 9. By the Gods. Chantique à la Valière leaned against the stone wall of the tunnel entrance, trying to keep his focus on the sentry task at hand. But his mind constantly drifted back to the city of Cuzor-Lauren. So many possibilities teased the shadows in front of the drow wizard, both with the openings available to him in the fledgling city, and with the opportunities that were opening up for practitioners of his craft, given the encroachments of Loth into the weave. But first they had to be done with this increasingly tedious surface war, Chantique kept reminding himself. It had started promisingly enough with some truly enjoyable battles. Chantique had been at the side of Ravel, noble son of House Zor-Lauren, though he now used the surname of Doerden, weaving the lightning web that had engulfed the front line of knights in silver when they counterattacked across the Red Run. And how deliciously effective and lethal that lightning had been on the riders in midstream. And then Sundabar. And truly, there had been no previous experience in Chantique's eventful life to match the thrill of watching the fall of Sundabar. He had been among the lead wizards in the last assault that had toppled the city, crawling through the tunnels to the substructure of the guard tower. Chantique couldn't suppress a grin as he recalled again the image of the lightning net climbing up the stones of that tower, the foolish humans leaping from the tower's top. Glorious! But now the siege had stalled, and this thing called winter seemed quite boring to the impatient drow. There were no seasons in the Underdark, but up here all was buried under a blanket of uncomfortable snow. This season was almost over, the orcs had assured Chantique and the others, and the slaughter could soon resume. But it had been a long few months, and longer still because Chantique had been assigned to this region, the tunnels north of the city called Silvery Moon. By all accounts, this city would likely serve as the next conquest, but for these months, the region had suffered nothing but boredom. Unlike the upper dark regions around the three dwarven citadels, where skirmishes were common as the desperate bearded folk tried to break free. Here, though, there was nothing. The folk of Silvery Moon seemed content to remain within their walls, and given the reputed number of wizards among their ranks, including their leader whose nickname was Thunderspell, they were no doubt weathering the winter, indeed all of the siege, with little discomfort. Chantique believed that they should be applying more pressure to the city, with magical and war machine bombardment day and night. He had said as much to Ravel, and it seemed to him from the Zor-Lauren's response that Ravel did not disagree. But Ravel had warned him to stand down. Tiago had turned his sights to the dwarves again, to Mithril Hall, for some reason Ravel would not disclose. Chantique could not let the matter drop, however. Not in his mind, at least, not with the incessant boredom closing in all around him. He was now in the second rank of advanced scouts, with only one fellow drow, a lovely maiden named Savin Selrue, between him and the open tunnels of the Underdark. Many times did Chantique fantasize about running out among those dark ways to find the encampments near to one of the dwarven citadels, to again use his magical repertoire to summon forth ice storms, to freeze the blood of his enemies and hear their dying screams, instead of the mundane tasks he was assigned in this eventless region. The drow heaved another resigned sigh. He knew that he should be fanning out to the east of Savin Selrue's quadron, but really, what was the point of such an exercise? Silvery Moon was behind them, with the only notable route blocked by a large encampment of orcs and ogres. If the folk of the city came forth into the tunnels, they'd be tied up long enough with the monstrous fodder for Chantique and the other dark elves to be long on their way to link up with Ravel's band in the northwest. He felt his magical wards dissipating and thought he should renew them. But to what end? Every day he came down to this area, protected from fire, protected from ice, protected from arrows, and with his array of magical wands at the ready on his belt. Every day, for hours and hours. Occasionally he might talk Savin into some playful recreation at least, but the witch was in a most foul mood this day, and had gone off to her haunts without even responding to his advances. Strangely, Chantique hadn't even protested, because in truth he hadn't even cared. Perhaps the many 10 days down here had turned even that former pleasure into tedium. So he stood there alone, and he thought of Cusor Larn. He'd be a good soldier here in this glorious campaign, and then he'd return home to make the most of his opportunities. And there would be some, he was certain, because some of the other drow wizards would surely fall in the fighting in this campaign, and particularly since Ravel would be going to serve in this ridiculous House d'Oerden in Menzo Berenzon. There would be room for ascension. The wizard waggled his fingers and produced a ball of fire, hovering above his open palm. He stared at the dancing flames, marveling at their interplay. Perhaps he could bring forth a sprite from the elemental plane of fire, a pet of sorts to dance around and amuse him. He wondered what such a fiend might sound like when he dropped an ice storm upon it. "Yes," he muttered quietly, staring into the flames as if looking for such a creature there in the palm of his hand. His attention was diverted then by movement down the corridor. He turned his head to look at it, thinking to dismiss the ball of fire. But before he even began that dispelling, he recognized that it was Savin approaching up the long corridor. Shantique nodded in greeting, thinking the female was waving at him. But then he realized she was warning him, telling him to flee. Shantique started to throw his ball of flame to the side, but again his attention was grabbed by the movement down the hall. As Savin Selrue sprinted toward him, and behind her there were lights, torches. Savin shook her hands at him, shook her head at him, and then the woman dived down suddenly into a forward roll, just as a spinning missile swept over her tumbling form. It went through Shantique's mind that he should have renewed his magical wards. Then the warhammer went through Shantique's mind, quite literally, and his every thought blew away in an instant. The conjured magical flame tumbled as the wizard dropped, landing right beside him, licking at his arm and robe, but he didn't feel it. Savin Selrue ran past him then, and had no time to pause and see if he was still alive, or to pat out the flames now growing on the sleeve of Shantique's fine robes. Glancing at the thick head of the warhammer embedded in the brains of her companion, she saw little point in going to Shantique anyway, except perhaps to retrieve the weapon. Her eyes did flash as she considered that possibility, for surely it seemed a wondrous weapon, despite the gore splattered about it. She just kept going. She had no choice. A powerful force of humans and elves licked at her heels, led by a knight in silver, a raging barbarian who seemed as big and formidable as a frost giant, and a clever little halfling who had already put one-hand crossbow dart into Savin's backside. She could feel the poison tip burning there, but she didn't dare slow to remove it. Around a corner and up a natural chimney, she'd be back among the orcs, and she could warn them and organize them and filter through their ranks and run away if they were overrun. The main orc encampment, in a large cavern, had been designed perfectly to fit the information presented to the 40 dark elves advising this group. They knew, for example, that the people of Silvery Moon had no underground route to get around their location to the tunnels north of them. The drow had scouted this region of the Upper Dark extensively. They knew as well that the folk of Silvery Moon could not come forth from their walled city above ground without being spied by the many eyes they had upon the place. And they knew, of course, that the other underground citadels of the region, the three dwarven fortresses, could not come forth to the aid of Silvery Moon, above ground or in the Underdark, without them knowing it long in advance. They did know as well that a small force from Sundabar had escaped into the Underdark through the subterranean granaries and the Everfire caverns below those. But this was a fleeing mob, after all, full of old women and children, of peasants and farmers and nothing more. And within a 10 day or so after the fall of Sundabar, this mob had been put out of mind. Perhaps the refugees had found their way to Everlund, or had escaped out to the east. More likely, most were dead in the Underdark, killed by falls or starvation or displacer beasts or umber hulks or any of the hundreds of deadly pitfalls and monstrous enemies to be found there. And so, when the siege of Silvery Moon had been solidified for the winter pause, this cavern had been perfectly designed, with defensive walls and high watch points, with ballistae even, aiming to the tunnels entering the southern rim of the cavern, the tunnels coming from Silvery Moon. Everything was aiming to the south, every barricade, every weapon nest, every scout position. A general sense of confusion and dread emanated from the words of the returning drow scout, therefore, when Sovyn crawled into the northern rim of the cavern encampment, warning of a powerful enemy force close behind. More than a score of dark elves were in that camp, along with 200 battle-hardened, well-armed, and well-armored orcs, scores of ogres, and a brigade of giants. Had they reformed their lines and turned their weapons around, the approaching force of refugees would have had no chance of breaking through them, let alone of defeating them. But there were thousands coming, Sovyn had assured them. From her perspective, judging by the sheer number of torches and the disciplined speed and confidence of the march, the leading band of powerful warriors, including a commander of the Knights in Silver, there could be little doubt that this was a coordinated squeeze. Silvery Moon, or one of her allies, perhaps a new force from outside the Silver Marches, was cutting off the main retreat lines and falling upon this encampment with all of her weight. The Dark Elves barely broached the possibility of standing their ground and fighting, and instead, in full, fled through the lower tunnels into the deeper Underdark. Giants jostled ogres, ogres thumped orcs, and orcs shoved and punched one another in the confusion that ensued. Where to go? Where to turn?
"Formations!"
one orc leader cried, but no one knew what that even meant in this oddly shaped cavern with tunnels coming in from all sides, from above and from below. One band of orcs moved to a wide northeastern tunnel, though to scout or to flee the others did not know. Nor did it matter, for such a barrage of arrows met them as they exited the room that those few surviving the surprising onslaught staggered right back in. Toward that tunnel ran a powerful square of ogres and giants, shoving a wall of orcs in front of them, and with scores of orcs trailing in their wake. But from a side tunnel in the east came the first enemies, led by Sundabar warriors and a knight in silver, and by a giant of a man and a halfling beside him. And they were led by a devastating volley of spears and by a warhammer thrown so powerfully that it dropped an ogre dead where it stood. Orcs charged at the enemy, but more orcs broke the other way, running for the western exits. The square of ogres and giants took a different route. Hearing the commotion of thousands, it seemed, they charged down the tunnel from which the arrows had come. If an unfortunate orc being pushed in front of the defensive shield array tripped and fell, it was crushed to death in short order by ogre feet in giant boots. Down they went, thinking to burrow into the back ranks of this approaching army. They crossed an area of broken stones and found many spikes among those rocks, cleverly set as caltrops. Monsters roared and the square's integrity shuddered. Ogres stumbled aside, grabbing at broken feet. Another barrage of arrows reached forth from the darkness, raining and stinging. But the monsters rolled on eagerly, ready for the kill, rolled on, and found a room where 100 small candles burned. Small candles they had thought the torches of an army far back along the straight corridor. They were chasing ghosts, they came to realize finally, when they were far from the encampment, far from the orcs and few ogres they had left behind, far from the actual fighting. The rapier whirled round and round about the orc spear, over and over, then reversing suddenly and shoving the spear wide. In sudden and brilliant balance, his upper torso barely shifting, the halfling quick-stepped forward and thrust once and again, and the orc fell away with blood spurting from two holes in its chest. Regis used the momentary pause to quickly cock and load his hand crossbow, and he sent a dart into the ear of an orc across the way, one charging into battle farther down the line. The beast stutter-stepped and grabbed at its ear, howling in pain rather than bloodlust now. Then it staggered and pitched forward, and the sword of a Sundabar swordsman cut it down. "Well fought and well shot, little one," came a voice from the other way, and Regis turned to salute Alina Brightlance, rapier coming up to his forehead, then diving out in front of him to turn aside the swipe of an orc sword. That orc pressed on, thinking its momentum would carry it to the kill, and indeed it disengaged the weapon and pressed it forward at the apparently vulnerable target. But up came a three-bladed dagger, intercepting the sword in a deft hooking motion, followed by a twist that nearly broke the blade and turned the orc's arm out wide. That gave Alina the perfect opening. She drove her opponent back with a slash and thrust, but turned the thrust to the side in time to slide her sword through the chest of Regis's enemy. That orc tumbled between them, and Regis rushed behind it, intercepting the orc coming back in at Alina, his rapier taking it in the shoulder, then the neck. The creature staggered, Regis retreated, and Alina lopped off its head. "Aha!" she cried. "Four kills! What will your giant friend think of that?" Her boast was cut short as a heavy missile soared in at the pair from the side beyond Alina. They both yelped and fell away, stumbling back into formation. Before their brains could unscramble from the surprise, was it a giant thrown boulder? The duo recognized the missile as an orc, and one quite dead from the weird way it lay there, all twisted and broken. Glancing back from where it had come, they quickly discerned the source.
"I doubt he'd be impressed," Regis replied dryly.
The source of the recent living missile was Wulfgar, standing amidst a pile of broken orc and ogre bodies, his hammer chopping out in front of him with heavy, brutal strikes.
"By the gods," Alina Brightlance muttered.
"Tempest, I believe,"
Regis answered, and they both shuddered as Aegis Fang came down hard on the ogre's head, exploding the misshapen noggin into a shower of blood and gore.
"That marks 10 at least,"
Regis remarked, following Alina forward to find more foes.
"And 4 of them ogres, by my count."
"I can count," Alina grumbled. Regis grinned and couldn't resist.
"And that does not include the ones he killed before we ever reached this chamber."
Alina cast a sidelong glare at him, but it was one filled with the heat of a good-natured rivalry and no true scorn.
"Your friend will claim a higher total than I," she admitted when the horns blew behind them,
indicating that the force out in the tunnel, leading the giants on a wild and fruitless chase, was coming in fast.
"To the south," Alina called to her charges. "Sweep clear the tunnels to Silvery Moon."
Alina moved past Regis to lead the pivot. They had never entertained any idea of a pitched battle in this cavern. Their force was more mirage than reality. They had hit fast and hard, and indeed it could be called nothing short of a rout, with scores of monsters dead and the survivors running. But this was the delicate part, Alina and the others knew. If those enemies still remaining in the cavern realized the ploy and the intent to flee, they might come on again, and that battle might well give enough time for the giants and ogres to return. Indeed, soon after she had started to the south, drawing the forward line around, Alina noted a distant orc up on a natural pedestal of stone, calling for its charges to turn and fight. But that orc was hit suddenly and brutally and went flying away. Alina turned her gaze back to the north to see Wulfgar's wicked grin.
"By the gods," she muttered once more, under her breath.
Regis awakened propped in a chair in a small room. The chamber was bare, save for a single chair and a heavy iron-bound door just a couple of feet in front of the seated halfling. Not sure how he'd gotten to this place, the halfling instinctively leaned forward and reached for the door, only to find his right wrist shackled, chained to a peg set in the floor behind the chair. Regis studied the tight metal bracelet, seeking a locking mechanism, but there was none to be found, just a smooth metallic ring. It looked like mithril, too tight for him to even think about slipping his hand out. A magical shackle, but how? His thoughts immediately went to the dark elves, and he found it hard to breathe. He shook his head, trying not to get ahead of himself, telling himself to recount the events. He remembered the planning for the assault. He had led the way on that. The initial charge was clear to him, as was entering the cavern beside Alina Brightlance. They had routed the orc force and pressed through into the tunnels Alina had assured them would take them to Silvery Moon. Indeed, Regis had some recollection of the calls of the advance runners, indicating that the defenders of Silvery Moon were in sight. He looked at the shackle again, at the material and the simple, elegant design, and ran the fingers of his other hand over it gently, searching for a lock, though he was certain of a magical seal. He hoped again that this wasn't a drow shackle, and held that thought and his breath as the door to his room opened. Regis breathed an audible sigh of relief when a man, a human, entered the room. Tall and broad-shouldered, and certainly an imposing figure, Regis found it hard to place the man's age. He had a thick head of hair with a bit of yellow in it, though it was mostly gray. His white beard was long and neatly tapered, and his dark eyes, ringed by fine lines, bespoke the wisdom of age.
I trust you are not harmed, he said in a deep and resonant voice, and an accent that, like his fine clothing, spoke of culture and sophistication. That realization gave Regis pause. He looked at the man more carefully and thought perhaps he recognized him.
Confused, perhaps, but not harmed, he answered.
Good. Then perhaps I can help clear up your confusion, the man said. He waggled his fingers and cast a quick spell. A chair appeared directly in front of Regis. The tall man spun it around and sat straddling it, leaning his elbow on its straight back. With his free hand, he reached into a pocket and pulled forth Regis's hat of disguise, which he hung on the corner of the chair's back.
Let us begin with your lying, he said.
My what? Regis stammered, staring at the hat. Where am I? Is this Silvery Moon?
Yes, and you were invited in, came the reply.
To be shackled?
After you lied.
I...
Regis fought for an answer, but really had no idea what was going on. He remembered more now, but it was still hazy.
I came in with Knight Commander
Alina Brightlance, yes, the man interrupted, and with the refugees of Sunderbar, though you were not one of those.
No, but we found—
I know your tale, little one. I am well acquainted with Alina, and have spoken with her at length.
Then you know I am no enemy of Silvery Moon.
I know that you lied to me, the man answered. We had priests watching with spells enacted when you and your large companion were questioned. Your friend Wolfgar spoke truly, but as for you, Mr. Paraffin—
My name—
Regis breathed. Spider Paraffin, so you said, but that was not the truth.
It is a half-truth.
Do tell.
Spider Paraffin is the name of my second life. I was reborn. It is a crazy tale, I fear. My name really is Paraffin, and the name I gave myself when my father would not—
He paused and huffed. There was so much to tell.
Spider, he said. They called me Spider because I could climb walls so well. So I kept the name, and so, yes, my name is Spider Paraffin.
The priests claimed that to be a lie, and I am inclined to believe them.
Because in my heart I do not hold to that identity, Regis admitted. And so to the perceptions of the priests with their spells, it would seem as if I was lying.
Pray continue, the tall man said when Regis paused.
My true name is Regis—
The halfling started to explain, but he stopped and stared harder at the man, recognition clicking into place.
I know you, he said.
Regis? The man echoed.
You were an advisor to Lady Illustriel, Regis said. But that was a century and more ago. Nay, wait, you were the High Mage of Silvery Moon.
That is no secret.
Do you not know me?
The halfling asked, but then caught himself.
Oh, of course you do not. My real name is Regis, and it is a name that you know or knew.
The wizard held his hands out, clearly at a loss.
I was friend to Brunner Battlehammer, once steward of Mithril Hall, Regis said. Friend to Drizzt O'Urden.
A fanciful tale, the man replied, in a tone that sounded less than convinced. And your friend?
He stopped there, his face twisting with confusion, and he mouthed,
Wolfgar?
He stared back at the halfling, then shook his head, a perplexed look upon his face. Regis grinned.
It is true, he said. Fetch your priests and cast the spells, I pray. And you are Tern Hornblade, yes? The wizard they call Thunderspell?
The man was hardly listening, as he was clearly trying to wrap his thoughts around this startling information, though surely not as startling to one of Tern's wizardly skills or one of his age. For even with the time spent in the magical forest of Eruladun, and even with the years after his rebirth, Regis wasn't nearly as old as this human.
What does it mean?
Asked a woman's voice, and Alina entered the room.
If it is true, then it would mean that these two you found in the Underdark are older than anyone in Silvery Moon who is not an elf and is not me, the High Mage replied.
It means more than that, Regis added.
Go and fetch the one called Wulfgar, Tairn bade Alina. They have a tale to tell, and it is one we should hear.
I am so glad that you have returned to us, Belinda Heavensbow said to Alina, wrapping her returned friend in a great hug. We had heard that you survived the Red Run to get to Sundabar, but feared you dead in that catastrophe.
I surely would have been, but for the blessings of the gods, Alina replied.
The last one into the keep, no doubt, Belinda said.
And she rubbed Alina's arms and smoothed Alina's thick brown hair, plainly needing that tangible proof that her dearest friend had returned to her. They were the same age, less than a year from 30, born within a week of each other, and to parents who had been close friends. They had joined the Knights in Silver together, and had served together for several years, until Belinda had resigned to help out her ailing father in his archery shop in Silvery Moon's trade district. Alina nodded solemnly.
Never will I forget that image, she whispered. Sundabar in flames, her wall fully breached, and with that foul drow elf flying around on a dragon, presenting King Firehelm's severed head as his garish trophy.
She paused and swallowed hard, wincing against the pain of the memory.
You must tell me all when you are ready, Belinda bade her.
Alina stared at her friend and nodded, recognizing the source of the curiosity. Belinda was a fierce warrior, and had climbed ahead of Alina even in the Knights in Silver before she had returned to her father's side. While Alina had gone on to become a knight commander, she had never once believed that Belinda would not have done the same if circumstance hadn't intervened. But it was not to be. And so over the last few years, Belinda had lived vicariously through Alina's exploits, always asking for tales of battles and skirmishes, and even prompting detailed stories regarding the more mundane aspects of Alina's duties, like arresting brawlers in a bar fight in Silvery Moon.
I've much to tell, Alina admitted. 4 months in the Underdark.
That is the least of the tales, Alina assured her.
4 months of hiding and little more.
As if on cue to give life to her words, Alina noticed movement beyond the open front of Belinda's shop and looked out to see a familiar figure seated on the porch of the tailor shop across the street. Winter had not let go its grip yet, and the day was cool, but Wulfgar hardly seemed bothered by it as he threaded a needle. He pulled off his wolfskin cloak and then his torn shirt as well, and sat there barebacked as he mended the garments.
Oh, I'm sure you'll find a bit more of those Underdark months to talk about, Belinda teased, and stepped beside Alina to get a better view of the huge barbarian, with his chiseled chest and muscular arms. Do you know who that is? Alina asked. There are rumors echoing about the streets.
More than rumors.
That is Wulfgar reborn, hero of old who reclaimed Mithril Hall in the first days of King Brunner Battlehammer's return to the Silver Marches. And that warhammer leaning against the rail is Aegis Fang.
Truly?
Truly.
An impressive man even without the history, Belinda purred.
Alina couldn't disagree, particularly since she had actually witnessed that one in battle.
20 kills in the fight that brought us from the tunnels alone, she told her friend, including a dark elf and 4 ogres, 20 kills by himself. He is barely more than a boy.
In this life, Alina reminded. He was a century old when first he died in the frozen north of Icewind Dale, and now he lives again and has grown anew into a young man.
Into quite a young man, Belinda said with a giggle.
It is all too confusing, Alina admitted.
I wonder, would he kiss with the calm and wisdom of an older man, or with the hungry eagerness of one barely more than a boy?
A most vital question, and one surely in need of a proper investigation, said Belinda.
Her eyes sparkled,
and a mischievous grin erupted on her face as she considered the question.
Perhaps a bit of both.
Alina started to respond, but lost herself in the view of Wolfgar, who was standing then and working hard to wipe some of the blood from the winter wolf cloak. She couldn't contain her smile, and her brown eyes, too, sparkled with mischief.
A pleasing thought, I agree, Belinda remarked.
Alina didn't answer, and didn't care that she was wearing her thoughts openly.
Perhaps I will tell you the answer when I find out, Belinda teased.
And as Alina reflexively turned to glower, her friend danced away, laughing, back to her work deeper inside the shop. Alina thought to go and help Belinda, but she paused and turned back, her eyes drawn back to the magnificent form of mighty Wolfgar, hero of legend reborn. Hardly aware of the motion, Alina licked her lips